Hi everyone, thanks for being here. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Today's Q&A, I'm going to go over quite a few things. You guys ask really good probing questions, and that is the purpose of this sangha, is that we ask sometimes the same question over and over again, but from your own perspectives. That is what the Sangha is for. Nichiren does the same thing. In his, the extant letters we have, I'm sure he wrote many more than are extant, even fragments. He answers the same questions over and over again. Sometimes he will answer from his own observations of the situation in Japan at the moment. A lot of times he includes histories of Japan. But almost invariably, he's using chunks of Shakyamuni's teachings, earlier sutras, commentaries by bodhisattvas like Nagarjuna, a lot from Tendai, Dengyo, Myaolo, right? That's his scholarship. He's able to show that there's a consistency in the teachings and the spread of Shakyamuni's Buddhism. Whether it's a fortunate thing or an unfortunate thing, I don't know. That could be debated. I'm stating the question before I state what I'm talking about. Apologies. But invariably, when you quote prior texts, especially in Buddhism, which is not only centuries but millennia old, the text that you quote will be in the form of the way it was taught in that day. So there's always an unraveling or unwrapping of sorts that happens in our discussion of the scholarship of Buddhism. And it's a conundrum, but that reintroduces confusion. Because what was satisfactory to the minds of 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years, 3,000 years ago, the exposure, the cultural realities, the manners of thinking about everything was far different than it is for us today. So when we try to approach, and I say we because we're all students of Buddhism, and we're all wanting to understand the significance of Buddhist thought. And a lot of times that Buddhist thought, especially as we go further and further back in history, is couched in the terminology of that day, which is irrelevant to us. Right? So we're kind of like solving a puzzle. That's how it feels, certainly. And this is why I make an effort so much in this, in these podcasts, in this part of my practice with the Sangha, to try to, I don't want to say secularize, but I try to put a more contemporary dialogue around these ideas so that it's more relatable, so that we understand with our own minds and our own concepts and our own realities what Shakyamuni was trying to get us to learn, to teach ourselves, right? So I get like this question from Nettie. Your video is much appreciated. Many thanks. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, the realms are only in this world in our minds. However, I can ask. So she's talking about the 3,000 realms. And when I talk about those realms being, or as Tendai did and Nichiren continues to repeat, that the 3,000 realms are different aspects of our life experience that we experience and make decisions and sift through in every single moment, thought moment of our lives. It's inconceivable how many decisions and leanings and tendencies that are at work in our mind. We operate very much in a consciousness in samsara that is far removed from the information and data that we sift through and make decisions on that govern the way we see the world, right? It's very deep and intricate. And when you study the nine consciousnesses and the 10 worlds, ultimately, this is what the 3,000 realms in the single thought moment is about. And influencing that train, that freight train of information and predilections, that's very much our practice of Buddhism, is to kind of subvert that train and go, okay, see all of that. Samsara is fine, but change our perspective on all of that epistemology and those layers, and see all of that from the ultimate layer, the Buddha layer, the clear layer that sees all the train sets, right? Instead of being so pushed, inertia and pushed into a perception because of samsara attachment, right? And see clearly what's going on. The same attachments, but seeing them as attachments instead of blindly following what we think is truth, right? So she's addressing that and she's saying, okay, I think I understand that, but so why is it in Nichiren that we so often read about things like Kalpas in the past and Avicii Hells and those kind of things? And so her question kind of, or his question kind of migrates between this life experience, no past life, no future life, no life after death, if you will, or before. That's one thing to explore. And the other thing being states of mind like the Avicii Hell, because it kind of transmigrates between the two, right? There's the Avicii Hell that we all can agree logically we experience right now when we're really overwhelmed, when we're super sad or depressed, or we don't see a way out of a situation. We are in the Avicii Hell. The Avicii Hell is no other place than this life of suffering, First Noble Truth. Life, because of the nature of samsara, is a gauntlet. But the gauntlet is of our own making. That's the great aha moment of Buddhahood, of Shakyamuni Buddha. This gauntlet wasn't laid down to make us suffer. We suffer because we create this gauntlet, and we create it moment to moment. And we can start to define how we create it with our monkey minds, our attachments, our emotions, blah, 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 blah. This is the subject of conversation for thousands of years. Identifying, describing, dissecting the way our samsaric mind holds us in a bondage with this attachment thing. That if we can just look over the horizon of samsara, samsara then becomes toys. It becomes entertainment. It becomes awe-inspiring. Look at what's going on, right? I talk about that all the time. The Buddha mind is unattached. But that doesn't mean you leave the world. It doesn't mean you have to annihilate everything that is samsara. You simply need to understand that it's a mechanism of experiencing this mind. And thusly is incredibly precious. You see the difference? Now, so why does Nichiren always, almost every letter he wrote, have these elements of older sutras that talk about far distant pasts and in the next life and so on and so forth? Nichiren is simply regurgitating those old teachings. Nichiren doesn't want us to lose our connection with where this wisdom comes from, where it was built, the stories it was built upon, the expedient means, the skillful means, the storytelling that brought us to this realization. So Nichiren is just being a dutiful scholar, just like when he dates something of the certain hour of the day of the month of the year, right? He's being analytical and scholarly by saying, this isn't just my opinion here. This opinion that I have comes from da 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 da. So this is why when we read Nichiren, we forget that most of his writings, and I don't know how he was in his casual dialogue with people, but when he committed his thoughts to writing, okay, so where was I? Right, so we covered the Nichiren thing. So yeah, he talks in his Go-shos a lot of these same expedient means because he's referencing them for a point that he's making in his letter or his treatise. And that's why. Not because he's continuously promoting this multiple lifetimes, other than that's our experience because we live moment to moment. So you'll remember Nichiren also talks at length about the 3,000 realms, Tendai. I've tried to modify, and you know, I'm taking a risk, but I'm modifying some of that translation from verbiage that makes it's too repetitive in the sense that today, to our modern minds, when we're told that in future lifetimes, when we read that, and I think that's an effect of the bias of the translation, what is really meant is our future moments, our future life in this samsaric circle, brackets samsara, in other words. And this is just unsaid in specificity. So if you understand that as we exist in samsara, there is a cycle of birth and life, birth and death, sorry. Right? That birth and death cycle is within the confines of this samsaric reality, this conditioned samsaric reality. It's the only place it exists is in samsara. Outside of samsara, outside of this manifestation of sentience, this human mind, there is no such thing. And I will remind you that when this is very clear, even from the get-go, when you read very early texts of Shakyamuni's teachings, that the Buddha's death is never called death. It's called extinction. Because this is a very finite thing. Extinction leaves samsara no longer cycle of life and death. That's within samsara that we have a cycle of life and death. In fact, as Nichiren harps on the 16th or 15th chapter, depending on your translation, the lifespan of the Tathagata, the lifespan of the Tathagata is a samsaric thing. And that's the drop the mic moment when he says, I didn't attain enlightenment in this life, in this samsaric life. This enlightenment has been here before samsara and after samsara. So what he's indicating is not his own enlightenment as Siddhartha, enlightened in samsara, that, yes, that, but this ability isn't something I invented, I created. This ability has always existed as long as there have been samsaric beings in their own samsaric time span. See, this too can be confused with, oh, so there's Buddha when there's no life. No. There's only Buddha when there is samsara. But the potential is for every samsaric experience before and after his enlightenment. So all of us, people prior to his samsaric birth and after his samsaric birth, have their own samsaric cycles of birth and death. You follow? It can be confusing, and Shakyamuni cautioned us on this again, I believe in the Lakavatara. Don't get hung up on the words. That's, man, our monkey minds are so expert at attaching ourselves to things. And then we want to make them so. That's our nature of our attachment. That's samsara, right? The minute we identify something, it's permanent. I got this. That's the very thing that Buddhism is trying to say. That's what's causing your problems. All your suffering comes from that mindset. You see? So, great question, Eddie. Yeah, I mean, when you see those Gosho, where he's quoting a lot of texts, don't get hung up on those words. Try to understand what he's trying to teach, what he's trying to point to. Not the pointing, but what he's pointing to. Search for the meaning. Don't get hung up on the words. That's a lesson for all of us, right? All right. Next, I got a list of questions from Irene, and she's a really good student. And she brings up something I want to talk on before I hit these actual questions. Many years ago, before I built this school, before I built this building, this building was a hope of mine that I was working toward manifesting. And my thinking then was, I've written a few books, and books are limited, always limited in their scopes. They're your thoughts and your epiphanies and your understanding of that day, that moment. It takes a while to write a book, so there's an arc of time in the book. A lot of times the book will end with insights that it didn't begin with, because that's the nature of our study and our insights, right? But they still have value because everyone's at different stages, and it may be this book or that book that made you go further and get more curious and learn more deeply for your path to your Buddha, right? Your realization of Buddha, right? But I thought, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek title, isn't it? Big Book of Buddhism. If it were truly a big book of Buddhism, it would be endless. I would be adding, some of you may be old enough to remember the old encyclopedias. Even Britannica would, every year, would come up with a new volume, right? Or set of time, whatever. because your knowledge constantly expands. And even thousands of years ago, the teachings of Shakyamuni, people would give them numbers like 84,000 teachings or 180,000. I've seen different things with different estimates, to the point where some sutras will say the innumerable teachings of Shakyamuni. We get a lot of that in Buddhism. Innumerable, so on and so forth. The reason is because each of us is a number. And so there are as many paths to Buddhism as there have been, still are, and will be human samsaric manifestations with their own cycles, each of birth and death. So it's impossible to tell what word fragment, what intonation, what sentence, in which order the words are, will ding, light a bulb and you go, ah! And now a bunch of information you have shifts to this new understanding, right? Try to document every single one of those sparks. Innumerable, right? So to write a big book of Buddhism, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. But I will tell you, my goal wasn't to be a smartass. My goal was, I want this school, this kun, right, which is an ancient Chinese word meaning sacred place of practice and study. So I wanted to invite people to come to this school. I still do. Knowing full well that I am in a remote location in the Bible Belt of the United States, and the likelihood of me filling the room is, realistically, it's pretty low. I want it to be great. I want you guys to travel thousands of miles to come see me. Not really. I'm not that selfish. You are traveling thousands of miles, though, oddly enough, through the internet. So this has become my school and my sangha. And what I've discovered, and actually writing the book kind of pushed me into this, I realized that the book could only be, I tried to make the book a framework of, bites of those 84,000 teachings. And my focus, rather than reintroducing Buddhism in all of its aspects, was to answer some core questions that are commonly misunderstood, but quickly get to how do you practice this thing independently? Because I realized that this was the path of today and the future, is that getting together in large groups in one building was going to be more and more difficult. That if true Buddhism, Shakyamuni's Lotus Sutra, was going to spread far and wide, as he predicted it would, as Nichiren predicted it would, that he would be the first to set that ball in motion, that it was all of Jampudvipa, the entire population of the world, that needed to move in this direction. Well, you can't get that into one building. So how do I do that? And then along comes the internet and YouTube and podcasts. Holy crap, we have a mechanism to do it. It's just that our building is virtual. So, how do I put together a handbook that's true to certain concepts of Buddhism and makes a respectful methodology for the individual to create a proper understanding of an altar, enshrinement, the elements of the altar, what these beads are about, right? The stuff of practice. How do you do that and know that you're doing it right? And since we're all human in samsara, there are certain points in our lives that we like to memorialize or have ceremonies for. They're helpful in conditioning our minds, right? Like when a loved one is deceased, extinct, How do we honor that life and how it influenced us? Remember, they're extinct, but their DNA, their influence, still very much alive within our experience. And so we can still honor them within the confines of our own life experience, because they still exist, their influence still exists within us. How do we resolve that influence with their extinction and our ongoing honoring, edifying of that influence? That's what the ceremony for the memorial for the deceased is. It's not about altering somebody's karma outside of samsara, because there is no karma there. Karma is energy and work. There's energy, but there's no work going on out there. The work happens in samsara. I hope I'm making that clear. So, the book, just to finish on the book, I could just say flippantly, well, it's outdated. It's something I did years ago. But I don't think so. I think it still has great value in that it does have some basic answers to how to practice, how to set up an altar. What does life looks like? I Ching looks like? What's the 3,000? There's each one of these. And actually, Irene says it. I love this. Where she said it? Where did she say it? Anyway, she mentioned, she said, I will spare you the rabbit holes I went down trying to answer these questions. Yea, verily. Because there is the conundrum in itself, that each one of these sound bites, these ideas, when presented, starts sparking all kinds of questions and insights. And you could start diving down into the scholarship of Buddhahood to... You can nettle as far as you need to nettle in order to finally go to come to rest and go, I now get this, right? Sometimes just a little bit and you go, I got it. Sometimes you got to go really far down the rabbit hole to finally read something, maybe by Vasubandhu, and exhaustively, you know, break your mind going, what does this mean? And then one day I get it, right? All of us are different. Everyone's going to find our aha moments for ourselves. That's our Buddha path, right? Our Buddha wisdom required for our Guanzen, our Buddha path to Buddha-ness. So, yeah, I understand rabbit holes. But had I tried to cover every promulgation, every permutation of rabbit holes, in what the title of the book, Big Book of Buddhism, suggests, I'd still be writing it. It would be so voluminous, no one would publish it, right? We're on volume 147 now. So understand, Big Book of Buddhism serves its purpose as an introduction to several rabbit holes with kind of a mindset to be aware of as you penetrate that study. And then, by the way, if you're tackling this massive repository of enlightenment in writings, in theories, set yourself up an altar. This is the reason for these different things at the altar. This is how you enshrine. This is how you practice. This is Gangyo, this is chanting, this is what this means. If you want to do a memorial, this is how you operate your practice. Without going super deep into each of the concepts, it's a handbook, okay? So in that way, I hope it functions really well. And if there are problems with it, then like Irene, point them out. A lot of times won't be a problem with the book so much as something that requires more investigation beyond the limitations that I put on the book. So let's go through her questions. Last point on the book, I'm kind of stuck in the same place Nichiren was, and I'm not comparing myself to Nichiren. But Nichiren understood that in order to teach Buddhism correctly, he needed to honor the previous teachings of Buddhism. To put himself as in line as a votary of the Lotus Sutra, he needed to be strict with his own communications that say, this is why I say this, because Shakyamuni said this, because Tendai, Dengyo, because these scholars before me make it obvious, this is why I say this. So he was very scholarly about doing that. I don't claim to have the same depth of scholarship as Nichiren, certainly. But in my own way, I'm trying to honor where these epiphanies came from for me. This is the actual purpose of the Sangha, for us to rub all of our insights together so that we can promote further, deeper insights for each other and ourselves. And this is why I'm always profusely thanking you guys for participating, because my practice grows as I endeavor to help you in your practice. It's impossible not to. All right. How did the deceased gain benefit? So I've already touched on that. The deceased themselves no longer exist, right? What's the word they used when the Buddha passed? Do you remember? All right. His extinction. So when a loved one or someone we know leaves samsara, look at it that way, there's no longer anything we can do for them. They can't do for them, because ultimately all we can do is influence. And if there's nothing to influence, right? However, their influence in our lives lives on within us and others. And so if we can reach through their mental, through our mental conjuring of their influences, their memories that we have, to enlighten, to see the Buddha-ness in that life, we are benefiting our own Buddha-ness and those of others we still know and love in this life, right? Once again, this is a demonstration of what Nichiren would call earthly desires are enlightenment. Does that make sense? You know, my sister passed away in 1986 at age 25. It was hugely traumatic to me. And over the years, my cognitions, my profound experiences of her have diminished. And I could be very, very sad about that. But instead, what I've come to understand is that when I've had those profound moments after her extinction, without even fully understanding it, I was practicing Buddhism. I would chant, do Daimoku, and as I did my prolonged Daimoku, my Shodai, I would see in my mind's eye visions of my sister, possible conversations, conversations I never had with her in life. But conversations I was now having with her. How is that possible? Am I communicating with an extinct spirit? No. I'm communicating with her influence and her partition of my life. And in that way, I could activate her Diane-ness. Her name was Diane. So the Diane-ness that I had in my own life experience was still alive in my mind. And I could chant with her, which I never did in my samsaric life with her. But I'm not communicating with the spirit. I'm communicating with my own mind, with my own love, with my own cherishing. And by doing that, I was performing expedient means. I was taking my desires for my sister to be, continue to be a communicator with me, and practicing my own enlightenment. And her own enlightenment as a part of my cognition, my samsaric reality. But I wasn't affecting some bag of Diane out in the ether. The bag of Diane was in me. It was part of Sylvain. But these rituals, these ceremonies, they're very significant for us human sentient beings in samsara. So rather than just tossing it aside as idle worship and stupidity, Buddhism says, once again, use your earthly mind, use your samsaric mind to your enlightenment, to quell your monkeys, your attachments. See, that's what was really happening. That's why I don't think of her much these days. It isn't because I don't value her episode in my samsaric life. I have tremendous praise and respect for her life. But my attachment to Diane-ness is now, it's quiet. It's something I just feel internally. And when I do think of her, it just kind of lightens me a little. There's no more stress about it. There's no more urgency about it. There's no more pain about it. The suffering has gone. How'd that happen? Namo myoho renge kyo. I have quelled those formations of attachments, those monkeys, and I am now in my Buddha-ness about it. It's simply something that contents me, that I deeply appreciate, is part of my life, continues to be, but not in an attached, painful, suffering sort of way. The memorial for the deceased helped me arrive at that. Do you follow? Yeah, a new Buddhist name is given to the deceased to also release them from their earthly attachments and to begin a new existence integrated with all life. Is this only for the benefit of the mourners? If not, how could this be needed by the deceased? You're absolutely right, Irene. That's exactly what I was just saying. That whole ritualistic thing, that's old. I didn't create that. That's an old... Again, a manual for how to do this. But the significance of it, in fact, even changing the name, altering the name to make Diane called Bodhisattva of Worth. That's a naming conviction, a convention that indicates my valuation of Diane, not her. You see, by just renaming something, we claim ownership of it because that's what we do, samsara. But okay, if that's what we do, then how do we use it to a positive end? Earthly desires are enlightenment. By renaming it something I own, it being Diane, by renaming her something I own, I then can focus on the enlightenment of that thing that I own. Do you see the mechanisms at work? So yeah, it's for the mourners. Great question. Thank you for asking it. Funeral services, same book, specifies timeline for observe. 49 days is noted as being the full period of time ascribed to passing of the deceased sinner. So it's hoped, again, this is just a formal device that goes way back in the history of Buddhism. But basically, the numbers have significance in many ways. There's a lot of, I don't want to, once you go down those rabbit holes, it can get mystical. And that's the wrong way to interpret this stuff. But certainly, I'm going to use an old Western adage, time heals all wounds. So what Buddhism says is, well, exactly how much time? Right? That's so human. Well, how long is this going to take? I want to be over this right now. How long is this going to take? When can I get my car back? Right? This is what we do with everything. So a structure was put into place by monks, organizations, and said, look, grieve. For the first 7 days, you're going to grieve deeply. So you need to do this much. For the next 14 days, you're going to start to ameliorate. And you can focus this much energy on that as you practice. And by the time you get to 49 days, this is almost 2 months, there should be a great weight lifted from you of this. Now, I can remember with Diane, it took me that moment that I thought I could actually tolerate being around other people again, took me like 3 months. So these numbers, they're relative markers for you to understand that grieving is a process. The depths at which you grieve change over time. And that you should be able to put a limit on how you obsess about things. This is an encouragement to say, okay, that's enough now. Right? There's this aspect of Buddhist teaching that's parent, teacher, and sovereign. It's compassionate, but it also promotes moving on. This is now not grieving anymore. This is an attachment in itself. And this is not good. So move on. That's what that's about. Does that make sense? And so, yeah, the part of it that says, ascribe to passing of the deceased from the human sentient state to the resting and fully integrated place of Ku. Right. Well, this is within your own samsaric existence, right? Because they're already there. It's your coming to it in your own samsaric realization. Lastly, several videos are talking about the process of conception, a man, a woman, and a third. Might that third be the potential energy associated with the deceased? No. Well, that's the short answer. I can make a more complicated answer, but I don't want to confuse you now. This is, again, obviously, this is very meaningful to you. So I'm not belittling it, Irene. I'm not. But this aspect of a loved one, deceased, extinct, is obviously something she picked up on a lot in the Big Book of Buddhism. So let me address that maybe a different way. You may have already resolved that with what I've already said, but I don't want to minimize your question. So let's take it apart in light of what I've already said. Birth. I've talked about birth many times. I think the world over, not just the West, we perceive of birth as the combining, integration, the interplay, the combination of a sperm and an egg, a male, a female. And the minute we start identifying like that in samsara, we limit our thinking. And I take you back to my discussions on energy and work. Energy isn't male or female. It's not identifiable It is the requisite life process given to an action, work. Whether it's a thought, an idea, words spoken, or a physical action, all of those things start from an initiation, what Buddha called formation. Now understand what formation means. It's something we encounter a lot, but it's not always called out specifically in our practice of Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Right? Not the monkeys themselves, but the formation of the monkeys. Where do they come from? So that energy, pervasive, that is the life process ingrained in the universe itself. The work is my favorite word that I've made up, the combinatory thing, the thing that combines, that amalgamates to become something, from nomina to phenomena. We can dance around words all day long, right? So, sperm, egg, don't necessarily produce a birth. If they did, we'd have a lot more people on the planet, right? So what's going on there? The sperm has the karmic energy of the male in this equation. The egg has the DNA, the chromosomes, the identity, the karma energy of the female. But why doesn't every single combination of them result in a birth? Because in Buddhism, we understand that there is a third entity of energy and karmic work that captures that moment of the male and the female, sees that there's a sort of there's a fit there. And this particular energy and work manifests in this sandwich, male, female, you. So that when you are born, or when you are still a zygote, you are a combination of your energy and work with the energy and work of both the others. There is a triplet that happens there. That energy and work that finds a fit, that locates itself in the combination of those other two, they are a formation that exists all the time in the universe. This is the life force. It's not that when Bob was deceased, his energy and work went into a holding pattern. Because the energy and work, the karma, only happen in samsara. Anything outside of samsara is just the cosmic force, if you will, of life seeking manifestation, not actively seeking, not consciously seeking. It just is energy looking for work. It's unemployed. And there happens to be an opportunity with this sperm and this egg that, hey, there's work to be done. Let's go do work. But the moment work combines with energy, there are tendencies and conditions, and then karma is formed. That's when the karma's formed. It doesn't exist out there. The karma's formed as soon as work begins. And this is why, as it forms in this zygote, into this fetal, this fetus, it, of course, inculcates that same, that energy and work from the other two. But it's still its own independent thing. It's just greatly influenced chemically, biologically, by the other two. This is why we share traits, eye color, hair color, skin tone, right? Does that make more sense? When we die, the work stops. There is only energy. Not good, bad, not Bob, Ted, Alice. The work is Bob, Ted, Alice. The energy, nomina. There is no attachment. Okay. It's a well-constructed set of questions, but they really all resolve around the pain of losing someone you loved. Your experience of losing a great influence on your life. It's traumatic. It's very hard to silence those monkeys, let alone the formation of those monkeys. Please know that time will change that. You must change that. And the way you change that is by Daimoku, chanting to your mandala. Enliven, invoke your Gohonzon, your perfect understanding of the Buddha's Dharma, so that you can awaken your Buddha. Doing this will release you from the bondage of that pain. And you will rely, you will feel fully integrated then with that influence in your life. What could be more heartwarming, right? So, intense questions, great questions. I'm glad I got to say something about, because more of you are buying a Big Book of Buddhism, and I think it's been long overdue that I give you a framework for what that book is for, okay? It's a framework on how to practice independently, but it doesn't answer everything, not even close. But hopefully it provides enough portals, enough tickling of ideas that it helps your practice grow, which would be my goal with the book, to help provide insights and questions and, yeah, rabbit holes. Chase them down. Ask me about them. May save you some parts, some rabbit holes. I may answer those all together for you. Hopefully I can. That's my hope, right? And that's why I'm doing this. And that's why, once again, I have to abundantly appreciate you for participating in this process. This channel, these podcasts are my Big Book of Buddhism in a much more real sangha, right, kind of way. Namo myoho renge kyo. Please be good to yourself. Protect your health. Be kind to one another. And, you know, send me these questions. They are wonderful. Because all of us are asking the same questions in some form or another, right? And believe me, if you catch me off guard with something I hadn't thought of or don't feel like I can answer, you will set this little research machine to task. I will find out. And if I can't find a definitive answer, I'm going to share with you a lot of rabbit holes and why I think some are worth pursuing and some are not. I will not be silent, because this is my life, is this sangha. So thank you for making it of some value. Okay? Take care. I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now. Hey, thank you for being here. Did you know there's a third way you can help support this channel? And it won't cost you a cent. Yep, if you are not able to be a patron on Patreon or use the PayPal me at .com at Sifu Sylvain because you don't have the financial fortune to help support this channel right now, you, as I say, always support this channel by watching. But you can also help us grow so that maybe one day we can get over 10,000 subscribers and YouTube will grace us with monetization. It's not a lot, but if you can make sure you're subscribed and share a video like a simple one, just go into the search criteria and type monk and you'll have a video that'll come up that's been up for years about what is a monk. You know, it's called monk, who, how, where, something like that. That might be a great introduction to somebody who doesn't understand what a monk is to begin with. It's a tool. Use this channel as a tool to help you with your bodhisattva practice and share a video to somebody who you think, oh, I know somebody who will benefit from watching this. And in that way, you can help us grow. And that's a really good way to help your practice along as well. So just wanted to drop that in on you, in case that's something that you might find useful. Take care of yourself again, and I'll see you soon. Bye.